Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and now, in a moment, a conversation on drinking. A former college president says lower the drinking age so colleges can teach kids how to drink without drinking themselves to death. But first, there are news reports that the North Carolina Attorney General's office is going to drop all remaining charges against three Duke University lacrosse players accused last year of sexually assaulting a woman hired as a stripper for a team party. Rape charges were dropped last December. The remaining charges are sexual offense and kidnapping. It's a case that rocked the campus, drew attention to the lacrosse team's partying, and cast doubt on the district attorney, Mike Nifong, who initially prosecuted the case and is now facing ethics charges. And today, the families of the accused asked Duke to pay their $3 million legal expenses. Well, North Carolina Public Radio reporter Rusty Jacobs joins us now from Durham. Rusty, what is the word there on what the Attorney General is likely to say this afternoon?
Robin, all indications are he will announce that the state attorney general's office is dropping the remaining charges, sex offense and kidnapping, against the three defendants. You remember this saga first started about a year ago with this team party off campus at Duke University, where the charges were first alleged that the three defendants gang raped this woman, a black woman who was enrolled at North Carolina Central University in Durham, a historically black college. And it immediately was set in the media as a case of the privileged against the underprivileged, rich against poor, white against black. But soon after the charges were first made, some credibility questions started to creep in about the accuser's story. Details about what happened that night, according to her story, came into question. The number of men she may have been attacked by, that changed. And then DNA results came from the first and second round of tests, and all indicated indications were that there was no evidence of sexual contact between the defendants or any member of the lacrosse team and the accuser. In fact, the director of one of the DNA labs testified at a pretrial hearing that after discussion with the DA, he understood that he should withhold evidence or keep out evidence that could be called exculpatory, that would clear the defense, because it indicated that the accuser actually had sexual contact with multiple males, none of whom were the defendants, prior to this incident.
This is Durham County District Attorney Mike Nifong. As we said, he'd been prosecuting the case. He's now facing ethics charges, has had to recuse himself from the case. So what else is he being charged with? You mentioned the head of the lab saying that he got the clear message from Mike Nifong to withhold evidence. What else is the charge against him?
Mike Nifong was first charged by the North Carolina State Bar, the licensing agency that could take away his license, first charged him with making inflammatory statements to the media against the defendants that could prejudice the public and even the jury pool against them. The State Bar expanded its charges, alleging that the DA purposely withheld exculpatory evidence, evidence that could clear the defendants or could at least help their case in protecting themselves against these charges.
Well, meanwhile, you mentioned that this has exposed some fissures in both class and race, the accuser having attended an historically black school across town. But also, you know, focus was now on the team, the lacrosse team at Duke, and their rowdy partying. One player sent out a vulgar email. So the feeling then was sympathy for the young woman. What's the feeling now?
You know, I would have to say that you find a lot more people willing to say that this was an overzealous prosecution by the district attorney based on very shaky evidence, that it should have never gone this far, that the charges should have been dropped a long time ago.
Have there been changes in policy towards the partying at the school, or is there a sense that that was blown out of proportion?
No, there have been sweeping changes. Duke University took this fairly seriously. You remember, for a while, the lacrosse team and its program was suspended. Then the school reinstated the program. The team is back competing. But what Duke did was they had this campus culture initiative. First of all, the school bought up about a dozen of these homes in the off-campus area that were used for excessive partying by students. And there are other changes taking place on campus, all aimed at reducing the amount of excessive drinking or underage drinking, trying to get people to party in a more wholesome manner on campus.
And Rusty, one last question. Two of the accused dropped out of Duke. We know they're on their way back for this afternoon's announcement. Any whiff of perhaps lawsuits in the wake of what is potentially going to happen, that all the charges are going to be dropped?
I spoke with a representative of the families today, and the families and their representatives are not saying whether there will be any kind of lawsuit filed against Mike Nifong, the district attorney, but they did say that he could be sued with civil litigation for, say, defamation of character. He may have even exposed himself to criminal litigation for something along the lines of malicious prosecution.
North Carolina Public Radio reporter Rusty Jacobs. Rusty, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we turn now to Rider University in New Jersey. That school is forming a task force to study the use of alcohol on campus after the recent death of an 18-year-old freshman. Police say Gary DiVercelli had a blood alcohol level more than five times the legal limit after binge drinking during a pledge initiation. Well, John McCardle says DiVercelli's death at 18 is exactly the reason to lower the legal age for drinking from 21 to 18. Now, that might sound counterintuitive, but McCardle, who was president of Middlebury College in Vermont for 13 years, says lowering the drinking age will take it out of fraternities and allow college presidents to openly teach kids how to drink responsibly. Well, that has groups like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, well, hopping mad. John McCardle is now president emeritus at Middlebury. He's formed an organization called Choose Responsibility. Its aim is to lower the legal drinking age, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Let's start with that terrible death in New Jersey. I know a student died on your watch at Middlebury as well, right?
Yes, a student who was age 22.
Yeah. Well, this young man, according to the Trenton Times, told his girlfriend he would not be able to leave that fraternity house until he'd finished an entire bottle of lemon-flavored vodka. As we said, he died of alcohol poisoning. Some would say no matter how low the drinking age, those college fraternity rituals are going to happen. So what do you say to that?
I can't disagree with that. Much as we would like to see traffic fatalities reduced to zero and alcohol-related fatalities overall reduced to zero, we know better, given the imperfect world we live in, than to expect that as a realistic outcome. I think we need to ask ourselves several very profound and fundamental questions when we hear news reports like this. The first is this evidence that legal age 21 is working? And secondly, why ought we to think that lives lost on the highways are any more precious than lives lost to overconsumption of alcohol that, because of this law, has been forced into darkened corners, underground, and off campus?
Well, let's take a second and remind ourselves of the history here, especially when you say lives lost on the highway versus in dorm rooms. Back in the 70s, groups like MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, connected drunk driving accidents with underage drinking. Then, under pressure from MAD, Congress raised the national drinking age to 21 in 1984. And today, groups like MAD point to the fact that there have been fewer highway fatalities since then as a reason to keep the drinking age at 21. You say what?
I say Mothers Against Drunk Driving deserves a great deal of praise and credit for educating the public over the last 20 years or so about the risks of drinking and driving. And I think to them accrues a great deal of credit for the fact that alcohol-related traffic fatalities have declined in every age group. Now, the fact that they've gone down in the over 40, over 50, over 60 group, it seems to me, is hard to ascribe to the 21-year-old drinking age. Furthermore, that downward trend commenced before the law was changed in 1984. In other words, those fatalities were going down even before the law was passed. Secondly, they remain highest at age 21, followed by age 22, followed by age 23.
Will you and your group point to other factors that might be taken into consideration, airbag, seatbelt usage?
Exactly. The same statistics that tell us about lives saved because of legal age 21 demonstrate more lives have been saved by safety restraints in the last 2 years than have been saved by legal age 21 in the last 22 years. Furthermore, in 2002, 75% of those involved in alcohol-related traffic fatalities were not wearing a seatbelt. Seems to me that we need to take those kinds of data into account as well.
Well, and as you say, one of the effects of the law is that it's driven drinking underground. How would, you know, making an 18-year-old legal change things?
I think we need to look at the environment that existed not just on college campuses, but everywhere in the country in the years prior to 1984. No, of course it wasn't perfect. Yes, of course, there were instances where students drank more than they should. But the fact is that alcohol consumption was out in the open. That allowed institutions to monitor it, to manage it, to educate about it. It allowed the social scenes to be downtown and out in the open. It permitted intergenerational social interaction between adults and allowed, as a result, for responsible choices about alcohol to be modeled. I think the most unfortunate aspect of this law is the fact that it has effectively disenfranchised and marginalized parents. Parents are placed in an impossible dilemma now of either looking the other way and condoning violation of the law by serving their children at home, or by strictly enforcing the law in their households and simply uprooting and transplanting the problem somewhere else.
Yeah, you're saying that when a kid has two beers with a pizza with some friends downtown, legally, he'll stop at two beers, whereas if he's up in his room with some six-packs with some friends hiding, he's actually going to drink more.
Not only that, the time and resources and energy we are devoting to enforcing this law is distracting law enforcement from spending its time dealing with the very serious problems of alcohol and drunken driving on the highways. I think it's interesting to look at what happened when the speed limits were changed in the late 80s. Everyone predicted that when the states would be allowed to set the limits, accidents would go up and carnage would ensue. In fact, exactly the opposite happened, and after the law was changed and after the speed limits went up, we heard from law enforcement saying that at long last they can now redirect their energies to picking up people who are genuinely menaces on the road and not have to waste their time picking up people doing 65 in a 55-mile-an-hour zone. That's a very good analogy to where we are with the drinking age today.
Well, you've got supporters and critics. Let's start with some of the critics. Henry Wexler of Harvard School of Public Health Alcohol Study thinks your idea is a poor one. He says 19-year-olds don't drink responsibly, period. If it were publicly illegal, it would be just as irresponsible. They don't have two beers when they drink a lot. And that lowering the age of drinking would lower the age of kids trying it illegally.
How does he know? We've gotten several recent reports telling us, A, that binge drinking is worse than it's ever been, and B, that underage drinking is worse than it's ever been, and that the age at which a young person may first sample alcohol is younger than it's ever been. That doesn't seem to me proof that the existing law is working very well. Our proposal, in fact, is for education and licensing, and it would contain a provision that anyone who violates the alcohol laws of their state before turning 18 would forfeit eligibility for the license. We think that creating such an incentive may have more to do with addressing the problem of underage drinking than staring into space and believing naively that the current law is working.
In fact, you say teenagers should get drinking licenses just the way they get driving licenses. They take a course in alcohol responsibility?
We don't have a problem with underage driving the last time I checked. And driver's ed works because there's a partnership between the family, the school, and the state, and there's the incentive in the form of a license at the end. It works, and I think alcohol education could be modeled on it.
That's John McArdle, former president of Middlebury College in Vermont. Now he's formed an organization to lower the legal drinking age. We'll hear more from him. And this is College Day on Here and Now. Later in the program, we'll take a closer look at that coach of the Rutgers women's basketball team who was so powerful in the press conference yesterday. Back after a minute break, Here and Now. Now and we're back with more from John McArdle, president emeritus at Middlebury College in Vermont. He's making the case that the national drinking age should be lowered to 18, and he's got his critics. Professor McArdle, as we said, president of Middlebury for 13 years, I have to make a disclosure. I happen to know that many of your underage students used to go to Lyons Market right there off campus because my cousins owned the market. And in fact, they had to give it up because they couldn't afford the incredible liability of underage drinkers and with false IDs. What did you see on campus? What's it like to be a college president?
It is incredibly frustrating, and it's not unlike being the parent of a college-age student because, as I said earlier, you face two choices, both of which are impossible. You either countenance the violation of the law and look the other way, and the message you send to the young adults in your midst by doing that is, in the long run, subversive of respect for law in general, because all you're saying is, if there are certain laws you disagree with or that you think are unjust, it's perfectly okay to break them. Or you crack down, and we're often told, well, all you need to do is enforce the law more rigorously, and you can solve this problem.
Is one of the challenges you face possibly that there's a class issue here? You're dealing with kids, as you said, on college campuses and the problems of underage drinking there. People who are concerned about drunk driving in many cases are maybe dealing with blue-collar issues of kids going out to bars after work and drinking. They may not be as sympathetic to your on-campus problems because they want their drunk 18-year-old kids in pickups off the highway. Is that possibly what's going on here?
I'm not sure that it is. The president of MAD made what I think was an unintentionally insulting comment the other day in response to that proposal by saying, well, this may be a problem in Ivy League America, but legal age 21 is working just fine in blue-collar America. I'd like to see the evidence of that. It may be working in a slight way relatively better, but let's look at the data and let's have the discussion. Underage drinking is worst in the state of North Dakota. That's not Ivy League America. I believe that this is every bit as much an issue for the infantrymen in the military, for the carpenter, for the mechanic, for the farmer, as it is for the college students. And well, I believe those families are every bit as affected by this as the parents of college students.
Well, in fact, one of your supporters is Michael Haynes at the National Social Norms Research Center at Northern Illinois University. He says when people talk about underage drinking, they really are thinking high schoolers or kids who they really perceive as too young to drink. But when you remind them that there are 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are married, who have families, who are in the military, they feel those people deserve the right to choose to drink.
Tell the infantryman who's just returned from combat in Iraq that he can't have a beer when he gets home, and try explaining why that law is good for him and why a state that would substitute its judgment for his, the same state that says he's mature enough to carry a weapon and defend his country, to sit on a jury, to sign a contract, to do everything else that an adult is permitted to do, but that his brain's not fully enough developed, his maturity is not fully enough advanced for him to consume a beer. Try making that argument to that person with a straight face, plausibly. I'd really like to see it done. I couldn't do it.
Professor McArdle, one last question. What are students telling you? The Chronicle of Higher Education spoke to several. One had a roommate who had been hospitalized for alcohol poisoning, and he said lowering the drinking age would only cause more reckless drinking on campus. What are you hearing from kids?
Well, I guess it's hard to believe that there could be more reckless drinking on campuses than we're having now, though I suppose that's always possible. What I'm hearing is that 18-year-olds are tired of being infantilized on this particular issue. They know perfectly well that the law in every other respect regards them as adults. They know that only four countries in the world have a drinking age as high as 21, and the other three are Indonesia, Mongolia, and Palau. They go abroad, they travel, they see young adults acting like adults, and they wonder why they can't be trusted. And they're unwilling to accept patronizing explanations that talk about their lack of maturity and the inability of their brain to lead them to make wise decisions. If we really believe that, and if that were really so, we should raise the age majority to 21.
Well, we should point out that one of the other students the Chronicle spoke with was for lowering the drinking age. He said that that would allow for safety controls. It would allow for fraternities to appoint someone to be trained and handle alcohol-related emergencies because it was legal. It's legal, and they can make it up front.
We need to have laws that reflect the social realities, not laws that reflect some particular group or individual's idea of what constitutes perfection. And to the degree that our laws are reflective of balance and maturity and common sense, those laws will be effective.
John McArdle was president of Middlebury College in Middlebury, Vermont for 13 years. He now heads an organization called Choose Responsibility, trying to get the national drinking age lowered from 21 to 18. And Professor McArdle, you're president emeritus now, but you know, you could be doing a lot of different things, one of them perhaps relaxing in a nice leather chair. Why do you feel so passionately about this?
People do look at me crosswise about this and say, my goodness, why, of all the things you might be doing, why did you choose this? Well, it's real simple. I wrote an op-ed article a couple of years ago right after I stepped down saying that there are certain things college presidents, for various reasons, are simply unable or unwilling to say while they're in office because they tend to be controversial and there are only so many issues you can take on at one time. I was very heartened by the response I got to that article. Many of those responses from college presidents saying, you know, you have it exactly right, and I support what you're doing. Now, it's awfully presumptuous to say that I'm taking this on behalf of all of my fellow or former college and university presidents. But I have to think, based on the response that I've gotten to date and by what I think is the willingness of the public to engage in this discussion, that this is a discussion worth having. These are serious issues. We're talking about the rising generation of leaders, and we're talking about whether infantilizing them and making a single exception out of them in this particular area is the best way to prepare them in the long run to conduct themselves as adults. If our laws breed disrespect for law in general, and if our attitudes infantilize, I don't think we're doing a very good job of preparing these leaders to assume those responsibilities. It's time to change that, and that's an important cause to take on.
The title of your op-ed piece was What Your College President Didn't Tell You, and he's apparently telling you now. Professor McArdle, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been nice to be with you.
So what do you think? Send us your thoughts. Send an email to letters@here-now.org. We want to hear from you. Still to come, our review of The Sopranos, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now.
Here and Now. CBS Corporation board member and former NAACP president Bruce Gordon said today that he hopes radio host Don Imus will be fired for the comments Imus made about the Rutgers women's basketball team. The Don Imus Show brings in about $50 million a year for MSNBC and CBS Radio, where his show is broadcast. Imus has apologized and plans to meet with the team. He's been suspended from his show for 2 weeks starting Monday. Well, in the midst of the controversy, Rutgers coach C. Vivian Stringer is moving into the national spotlight after making an inspirational speech at a press conference yesterday.
We all need to make changes. Yes, it happens to be Mr. Imus. But beyond Mr. Imus, it's all of us. Do we understand what's going on in our society? And maybe these young people who taught us, you know, how to be winners on the basketball court can also serve as examples as winners in life.
Meanwhile, a lot of people are saying, who is C. Vivian Stringer? Joining us now is Greg Lee, senior assistant sports editor at the Boston Globe and officer of the National Association of Black Journalists. Greg, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, we know C. Vivian Stringer is one of the highest paid coaches in women's sports, a reported salary of $410,000 a year. How'd she earn that?
Well, you know, over 30 years of coaching, she's led, you know, three programs to the NCAA's Final Four. You know, so she's in the third winningest coach of women's college basketball with over 777 wins. So you know, her record speaks for itself, and that she's one of the pioneers of the game, and she's one of the most respected coaches in the game,
bringing in millions and millions of dollars to the colleges where she's had these successes.
Exactly.
You know, I said it was an inspirational speech. Others haven't been thinking that. I don't know if you listened around.
Yes.
Talk radio. She was derided quite a bit for speaking, but let's hear her story. Some would say, how can you not call this inspirational? She spoke about overcoming racism in her own life, becoming the first black cheerleader at her high school, a decision that apparently school authorities made with some hesitation.
The first time I took a team, it was at Cheney University, but I wasn't able to experience that with great joy, because my heart was heavy. My daughter was stricken with meningitis and has been confined to a wheelchair since she's been 14 months. The second time was at the University of Iowa. My husband suddenly died to a heart attack. And that same year, I was to go to a Final Four. My heart has never been light in going to a Final Four.
As we hear there, Greg, an incredible life. It seems like every time she got close to the Final Four, she had
yes.
this terrible personal adversity.
Exactly. And, you know, it reflects it. Her team reflects that, you know, what she's gone through. I mean, what her team is known for is, tough defense, tough-minded, you know, very disciplined, and, you know, and overcomes a lot of things. She doesn't ever take anything, no excuses from her players because, you know, what she's gone through.
In fact, she's pretty tough on her team. They started off the year, as they all said, you know, terrible.
Yes.
And here she is speaking about how hard the team pulled together.
During the Christmas holidays, they spent 8 to 10 hours working and going through films and studying and working so hard to become all of what they could be. And ultimately, They ended up playing for the national championship. No one believed in them but them.
So what did Stringer do, Greg Lee, to get her team to work together?
Well, she got her team. You know, one thing she didn't have any answers actually. So she brought in a lot of her former players from her different coaching stops and had them, you know, talk to the players, because most of the team there weren't any seniors in this team. This is a very young team with a lot of freshmen and sophomores, and you know, Vivian's trying to figure out all the pieces of the puzzle for her team because they were just so young and they weren't getting her message. So she brought in the players that, you know, really, you know, brought in the players that came in from all around the world, you know, because they love to see Vivian and they love the program, and they talked to the kids, and the kids got, you know, motivated kids, and they actually teach them what Steve Vivian was trying to tell them and teach them.
So. I understand, too, that she took away privileges. I mean, this is...
Yeah, she took away locker room privileges, you know, stripping off the names of the locker room. You know, it's just, you're basically saying you don't have the right to be called a Rutgers player until you know, fulfill the things that she's trying to instill in them.
And let's let people know, when you take away locker room privileges at Rutgers, this is an amazing locker room with plasma screen TVs, a mini auditorium.
Yeah.
She also, we understand, wouldn't let them wear the Rutgers uniform at practice until they started playing as a team.
Exactly, because, you know, like I said, she has a very disciplined system, and she believe, you know, what she teaches, she hopes her, you know, team responds to it, and she tried all different type of motivation devices, like you said, in terms of, you know, taking away her, you know, she wanted to earn their R on their chest.
We understand, too, that she's no stranger to this kind of controversy. When she was first hired in the early 90s at Rutgers, there were critics who said that University President Francis Lawrence only hired her to defuse criticism he was facing because he said that African Americans didn't have the genetic hereditary background to have higher test scores. So how did she face that criticism that she was just sort of a token to offset the criticism of the then president?
I think, you know, with C. Vivian, it's just a life struggle, and what she's experienced in life, she knows she's how to handle that situation. Also, you know, even just with her hired, even with people saying that, before she got hired, she was already qualified for the job. So you couldn't really question her credentials, because before then, she took a small black school, historically black school, to the first championship game of the NCAA. She took Iowa, relatively not really strong program, into a tournament, brought them into a Final Four contender. So, you know, in terms of her credentials, no one can really question, you know, her credentials. So even despite the comments that the president made at the time, you know, you couldn't doubt her credentials to become coach of that team.
Yeah. Greg, as a sports writer, in a couple minutes we have left, what do you think is going on here? I mean, I wondered, listening to the Imus comments, which, by the way, remind people, he and his staff thought they were complimenting the Rutgers team, which had a tremendous win. And they are, if you've seen now, if you didn't see them play, you've probably seen a montage of them playing since they are unbelievable.
Yeah.
It seems to me, you're a sports writer, it seems to me that these white males didn't have any language to describe these terrific female athletes.
Well, obviously, you can tell from the comments that they didn't watch the game on that night, the night before. You know, actually, what happened to the girls? They probably even know the story of the team for them to make those comments. And yeah, they thought it probably was funny because they thought, you know, they could, you know, sound like they're one of the hip hoppers or whatever. And you know, it was just some bad taste. So for one, like I said, those guys didn't even care about women's college basketball. And it's unfortunate because the sport doesn't get enough ink or, you know, TV time as it is. And when they do, it's usually with controversial stuff. You know, even before the Final Four, you know, with LSU being in the Final Four, they had the controversy with their coach being fired for whatever, I mean, resigning for whatever controversy there at the school. So anytime there's any controversy, you know, it dims the accomplishments of those young ladies. And there's certainly the Rutgers team, you know, with them making to the finals and what Dion Imus says, it really, you know, put a damper on what is supposed to be a celebratory time for them.
Well, let's let you have a whack at it. I mean, I heard it, and I only disagree partially that I think they did watch it, and I just didn't know how else to describe these, you know, incredibly scrappy, talented, strong would be a word you could use, players. How would you describe the Rutgers players?
Oh, I think they're, you know, like I said, tough defenders. It's a young team. They're trying to figure out their way. I mean, when you have tough moments in the game, they really had no one to really go to because it's such a young team. And plus, you know, they're often, you know, it's a scrappy team, and, you know, they ran into a team that just had a little bit more offensive firepower than they did. Rutgers is not really known as an offensive team. They're really, you know, play defense, rebound, and then try to score in transition. But, you know, in terms of that game, it was a tough night for them. They just had a bad night.
That's Greg Lee, senior assistant sports editor at the Boston Globe, officer of the National Association of Black Journalists, talking to us about Coach C. Vivian Stringer, who I think we're going to hear a lot more about. Greg, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And still to come before we go today, the mobsters and the travelers, the Sopranos and the new show, The Riches, what they say about the American dream. You're listening to Here and Now. presidential candidate John McCain began his campaign to jumpstart his campaign today by giving the first of three policy speeches. At the Virginia Military Institute, McCain defended President Bush's Iraq troop surge plan, and he told cadets that while he's been critical of how the war has been waged, and there is no guarantee the president's current strategy would succeed, it would be dishonorable to not move forward as planned in Iraq for now. And he told the story of visiting wounded Navy SEAL Mark Robbins in the hospital last week.
When I entered his room and approached his bedside, he struggled with great difficulty to sit up, stiffened his body as if he were trying to stand at attention, grasped my hand tightly, and wouldn't let go. And then he whispered to me not to worry. We can win this fight.
Joining us on the line from Washington, John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline, the daily political briefing on the National Journal. John, that was quite a moment there. I mean, was that one that struck you? And what else hit you about the speech today?
It was an extremely moving speech. At least parts of what McCain talked about were very personal and very emotional. As you said, he did just get back from his fifth trip to Iraq. But in addition to that, I think you also found that it was an extremely combative speech in tone, at least in terms of the way that he was trying to start the debate, or continue the debate, I guess, with Democrats on Capitol Hill, who of course control Congress, and also with the media. You also heard several references to the fact that he faces a hostile press corps, and those are two key sort of boogeymen that he needs to create as he tries to fight and reestablish good relationships with the conservative base of his own party, as he tries to reinvent or rejuvenate his struggling presidential campaign.
Right. And people like you and analysts are watching this very closely to see if, in fact, he can do that. He's 72, and the thought is, well, maybe there won't be another race, if not this race.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it so hard for him this time around? Is it just Iraq?
Well, it's Iraq. I think, as you mentioned, I think it is partly his age. It's the past 8 years in the Senate in which he's established himself as being quite a maverick within his own party, and he's made several enemies within his own party in the conservative base. I mean, he's worked closely since he ran for Senate in 2000 with Democrats like Ted Kennedy, you know, liberals who are highly reviled by the conservative Republican base. And in doing so, a lot of people, I think, at this point are sort of unwilling to forgive some of the alliances that he's made. Now, the National Journal did a recent sort of review of his votes over the past decade, I'm sorry, over the past Senate session, and he really has, if you look at the way that he's voted, he really has tacked quite dramatically towards the center of his own party, moving from being something like the fourth or fifth most conservative senator to something like the 40th most conservative. So you really do, in addition to the stylistic image things that have changed considerably with McCain, his actual vote pattern has changed.
Well, and John Mercurio, in a minute or so we have left, I'm just wondering if we just heard that clip of him speaking of visiting a soldier with a lot of emotion in his voice. I'm wondering if the thing that was once John McCain's strength post 9/11, the fact that he had been in the military, one of the few candidates who had, that he'd been, a hostage himself. I'm wondering if there's a funny way that might be tilting into a weakness if people feel he can't view things like the war in Iraq clearly without feeling like he'd be abandoning troops if he even discussed bringing troops home.
That's a very interesting point. But I still think, frankly, that the fact that he does have a very decorated military record remains one of his key strengths. I mean, he was able to say in the speech today, and I'm quoting here, "I know the pain war causes. I understand the frustration caused by our mistakes in this war." That's something that he alone in this Democrat in this presidential campaign is able to say. I know the pain war causes. He has, still has war injuries left from his own service in war, and so I still think that sort of gives him a credibility and a certain legitimacy that no other sort of top presidential candidate this year has.
John Mercurio is senior editor of The Hotline, the daily political briefing on the National Journal. John, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay, well, stay with us. The Sopranos are coming here and now.
now. You know the music. Every fan of The Sopranos knows A3's Woke Up This Morning, the opening track on the HBO drama that returned last Sunday night for the first of the final 9 episodes. What is it about this program that so captures viewers' imaginations? Well, the answer may be in another new television show. Critic at large Ed Siegel, who's seen every episode of The Sopranos, joins us now with more. Ed, hello.
Hi, Robin.
Do you like what you've seen in The Sopranos?
Yeah, I love the direction that it's going in.
But, you know, some people were worried that, you know, that it's maybe lost its fastball.
Yeah, because it begins on this quiet lake in upstate New York. Tony's sitting around with his wife and his sister's family, and it looks all very peaceful, but it didn't take long for things to turn really dark.
Well, let's review, first of all. The cast of characters includes Tony, played by James Gandolfini, as the capo di capo of the New Jersey mob, Edie Falco, Carmela, his wife, and they're joined at this beautiful lakeside, you know, moment by Aida Torturo as his sister Janice, and Stephen Chiripa as Bobby Bacala, her husband. And they're just, as you said, it's bucolic.
Mm-hmm. And they're celebrating Tony's 47th birthday. And Tony's looking out on this beautiful lake, and he and Janice pick up on something that we saw last year as Tony was fighting for his life after being shot by Uncle Junior, his his uncle with Alzheimer's. And as he's laying in that hospital bed, what is he dreaming about? He's dreaming about being a normal, boring, everyday salesman.
Let's listen to a little of that dream. That's from last year.
You never did tell us how you made the jump from selling patio furniture to Precision Optics.
Well, like my wife says, that's a good question. Excuse me for 1 minute.
Hi, Daddy. I meet volleyball.
All right. I told you, didn't I? You were worried over nothing. How's your brother?
Mom put him to bed early. He puked.
Oh, no. She around?
Mom! Bye, Dad.
Bye, baby.
That's Tony Soprano's dream when he was dreaming again, as you said, that he was, you know, a salesman.
Who knew that deep down he really wanted to be just like us?
Well, and the writers picked up on that last week again with that bucolic scene.
It starts out like a remake of On Golden Pond at Janice's and Bobby's lakeside house. Here's Tony reacting to his birthday party.
To my husband, you're not just a funny, smart, lovable, good-looking guy. You're mine. Thank you, baby.
Oh, happy birthday.
Chin down, Anthony.
To have my health, to be in this beautiful spot with people that I love, well, I couldn't ask for more.
Well, of course, shortly after that scene, Tony and Bobby beat the living daylights out of each other, and there's a cold-blooded mob, killing in a laundromat.
Right, but, you know, despite that, what's really interesting is that they're still yearning for these family values. And that's a theme that travels from one show to another on these cable channels these days, particularly the adventurous cable channels, and particularly the riches, the con artists on FX. You see it with Dexter, the serial killer on Showtime, and the polygamists on another HBO show, Big Love. They all want that good old American dream.
And that brings us to the other television show you wanted to talk about. The Riches are a family of con artists. And this is based on a real-life community called Travelers. They live in trailer park compounds. But in this fictional version, the Riches take over the lives of people killed in a highway accident that they are involved in, the Riches. They move into the home of the people who have died, take over their identities. They sneer at the buffers, and this is what they call the normal law-abiding folks. But as you said, they're trying to become one of them. Eddie
right.
Izzard's character in particular, he's the dad in The Riches. He kind of likes what buffer life, normal life, has to offer.
That's right. And the writers are very clever about the way they both celebrate the American dream and satirize it at the same time. But Eddie Izzard's character, Wayne or Doug, whichever one
today.
You want to call
right.
him, he's really living that dream that Tony had last year. He's got his wife and his 3 kids, the house in the suburbs.
Of course, faking it all the way. Let's listen.
So how do we use these cards?
We use them to enroll you kids in school.
Would you stop scaring them?
I'm serious.
So am I.
Dad, come on. School? Who wants to learn a bunch of buffer bullshit?
School is the cornerstone of buffer society. It's where you meet a lot of buffer friends and learn really important things.
Oh, Wayne, it will kill their tiny minds.
Of course, this being Eden Falls, that's the name of the suburb, Eddie Izzard's entree into the American dream is not going to go smoothly. And it's not going to go smoothly for the rest of the family either. As we saw last week with the suicide of the dentist that Minnie Driver's character worked for, that American dream has its own set of traps in terms of people sacrificing their families for their careers. Mm-hmm. Despite that, the scenes that are most moving about both the Riches and the Sopranos are those in which the characters are actually yearning for a way out of their transgressive lives. They really want to be assimilated into the greater society, and they actually find quite a bit of honest value in that. The Sopranos and the Riches really do believe in the American dream.
You know, and I'm thinking, too, as do the people in Big Love, and to remind people, this is the polygamist Mormon family mm-hmm. that's broken away from sort of a cult-like larger Mormon family. And I'm reminded that in all three of the shows, The Riches, The Sopranos, and Big Love, there is a larger family. In Big Love, it's this polygamous cult. In The Sopranos, it's the mob. And in The Riches, it's the travelers, the real-life con people. So do you think in The Sopranos, you know, Tony might end up selling patio furniture?
Well, I wouldn't bet the house on it. The first episode, as you mentioned, stayed about as idyllic as a day in the life of downtown Baghdad. And this coming week, where he begins to doubt Christopher's loyalty, has even more of an air of doom about it. More important, he also doubts Christopher's love.
This is Tony's cousin.
That's right. But he's kind of more of a surrogate son, particularly with AJ screwing up left and right.
His real-life fictional
his real son, yeah.
Or whatever you want to call him, yep.
Here Tony is talking about the pain he feels from how he's portrayed in Christopher's new horror movie, Cleaver.
Which he's funded.
And he's talking, of course, to the great Lorraine Bracco, as his psychiatrist, Dr. Melfi.
You always talk about him more like a son.
In some ways he was, especially after his dad died. He was little, I used to give him rides. I'd put him in a basket at a butcher bike and pedal him around. Back when Satriani's made deliveries. I reminded him of that recently. He didn't remember.
But you do.
We had fun. All those memories are for what? All I am to him is some old bully.
A sneak peek at the upcoming Sopranos. We won't tell you anymore. But, you know, we're reminded some of his sessions with Dr. Melfi also do point out that, you know, he's yearning to be mm-hmm. part of mm-hmm. our world.
He wants that normalcy, but the power and the machismo that got him that power aren't easy to give up. And there, too, maybe we see something of ourselves in Tony. So there's a little bit of Tony Soprano in all of us, but one of the things that makes that show so special is that there's a little bit of us in Tony Soprano, too.
Critic at large Ed Siegel on The Sopranos, a little bit of The Riches, and television shows yearning for the American dream. Ed, thanks so much.
Salute.
Okay. Ed Bugsy Siegel.
Love her. Love's gone.
The Sopranos airs for 7 of the next 8 Sundays on HBO. The Riches airs on Monday nights on cable channel FX. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.